It's really a great honor to be here. I mean, it's really just, as I say, a dream for me. So thank you to Henry and to the Gloucester Writers Center. I do teach writing and literature, and my classes are pretty freewheeling affairs. And so if any of you have anything to say during the course of my quote-unquote lecture tonight, please speak up, and that will be part of the lecture itself. So, the name of this occasion is Charles Olson and Finding One's Place. "I'm a cosmopolitan," said my friend Jerry Rothenberg when I told him the title of this lecture. "I'm not sure I want to find my place." I remember talking about the etymology of that word, cosmopolitan, with Ed Dorn one day, its great superiority to metropolitan, taking the long view rather than the local. On the other hand, this week I've been reading Peter Anastas' novel, Decline of Fishes, which deals with the mostly unsuccessful struggles of the local fishing industry in Gloucester to preserve itself against encroaching gentrification. And this week had my first look at the Man at the Wheel statue at the Fisherman's Memorial. "No difference, though," says Charles Olson, "when men come back." But that's the story. The local, or the cosmos, or, as the writer we're talking about tonight had it, the local as the cosmos. But as the flyer for this lecture says, I've lived a lot of places, from Oklahoma City, where I was born, to Czechoslovakia, to Seattle, to Encinitas in Southern California. And if my wife Sarah has anything to say about it, which of course she does, we'll be moving out of Southern California as soon as I retire from teaching in a few years. So, I'm an unlikely candidate to tell any of you here about finding one's place, unless I can somehow usefully complicate our understanding of that word, place, which I will try to do, and then I will try and simplify things again, because my real thesis, you know, in college we teach the thesis statement. So my real thesis of this lecture is a line from William Carlos Williams from Patterson that some of us all know here, but we forget every now and then. And here it is: "The writing is nothing. The being in a position to write, that's where they get you." So finding one's place for me is being in a position to write. Or as Jack Hirschman had it in the recent book Letters to Olson, Olson, quote, "is the one who most brightly shows the mind and heart how to begin." The key word, begin. The essence of what poetry is. You don't have a place just because you barge in on it as a literal physical reality or want it to prosper because you live there. Instead, go see the Grand Canyon. That's what it was made for. Place, you have to have a man bring it to you. You are casual. This is a really serious business. And not to be tampered with. That's a quote from an essay called What I See in the Maximus Poems by my old teacher and friend, Ed Dorn. That essay has been called the first important critical evaluation of the Maximus Poems, written and published in 1960. And this essay is an argument, in one sense, for place not being local, at least in the sense of parochial. Here's another quote from that lecture. "I am certain, without ever having been there, I would be bored to sickness walking through Gloucester. Buildings as such are not important. The wash of the sea is not interesting in itself. That is luxuria, a degrading thing. People, as they stand, must be created. It doesn't matter at all. They have reflexes of their own. They are casual." Dorn would always try and make simple location relative, most obviously in his epic poem, Gunslinger, but also in his Olson Memorial Lectures in 1981, which was published by Amiel Alkali. And here's a quote from, so I should just say, for those of you who don't know, that Ed Dorn was a student at Black Mountain College, where Olson was the rector. That's where Ed Dorn met Olson. And then I was a student of Ed's at the University of Colorado in Boulder. So there was that lineage there. And so here's a quote from Ed's memorial lecture that he gave in 1981, 11 years after Olson died. Realism, which Ed is in favor of, realism, precludes the occult, except on the coast. And the reason for that is that the coast is not the West, being infested with Orientalism. I was talking to Elizabeth before the lecture tonight about Buddhism, and I wanted to play you a part of that.
So I learned because the sky is big and clear in the West, for the same reason, and this is back to the astrology thing he's saying. Why realism precludes the occult, except on the coast. And the reason for that is that the coast is not the West, being infested with Orientalism.
In that essay that Ed wrote, called What I See in the Maximus Poems, there are some really funny sections about gods with eight arms and three faces. He was not a fan of Eastern religion, it's safe to say.
Or any religion.
And the thing about Ed Dorn was that his disdain was awe-inspiring. And to the extent that I got spiritual instruction in Boulder, it wasn't from the Buddhists, but it was from sitting around his dining room table with his wife, Jenny, and some of his other friends who were passing through. And so it was great to hear his voice again in this lecture, because it reminded me that to truly understand him, you have to hear his voice, his intensely ironic, sarcastic, deadpan tone of voice. And it was also Ed who got me on to looking at the writers of the 18th century, about which I will speak in a few minutes. Finding one's place. I was reading the New York Times this week about the NBA playoffs. I should tell you that I write about sports a lot. And there was a note about a player on the Golden State Warriors named Klay Thompson. And this is what it said in the New York Times. He thinks of the game as a process, describing himself as a continuous player. Rather than dwell on individual possessions, the makes, the misses, he searches for his place within the game's broader rhythms. There's a Zen-like saying about basketball that I like a lot, which is, let the game come to you. And all of this seems to be an argument for place being relative, dependent on the moment. This moment. Another local comment about the limitations of the local came from the Boston NPR station this week, a couple of days ago, where a woman named Amy Cuddy said that people will never attain presence completely. She said, you can't be here now all the time. And speaking of spiritual instruction, as I was a few minutes ago, I was glad to hear that, which is a reference to Baba Ram Dass, which is one of my early influences. Amy Cuddy, I looked her up. She gave a TED Talk on power poses. Those of you who... And so basically, Amy Cuddy's TED Talk was about if you would assume the actual physical postures of confidence, you will become confident. It's like a 2-minute, you know, like a self-help thing. And you should check it. You should check it out.
Is that her main pose? Is like this one here?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so when a person wins a race, at the end of when they break the tape, they go, and they look at that, you know, and they, triumph, power, you know. And if you assume that pose, says Amy Cuddy, you too will feel. That's it. I wanted to get back to the blurb on the flyer that some of you have in front of you for a minute. Henry quoted it in introducing me. I will quote it again. So to start, it's one's literal place, the ground that we're talking about. As Shakespeare wrote about his lover, my mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground. But that place can also be inhabited in other ways and has been by Olson and other writers like Geoffrey Chaucer, a place without hierarchy that exists without displacing other places, which is possible with the attention and the care, that's Olson, even when so few have the polis in their eye. That's the project, says the blurb, or at least that was the project, because to be honest, I had no idea what finding one's place meant when I proposed the title to Henry a few months ago. Of course, Olson's place was here, Gloucester, the city of Maximus, where the Maud Olson Library will open in a few weeks down the street. What else needs to be said? Well, perhaps that, quote, such a precise location, as isolated as it is, now seems almost a luxury. That's from Amiel Alkali, whose book, The Remarkable A Little History, largely about Charles Olson, but about a lot of other things as well. And Amiel says in that book, has not the velocity of change and consumption through some law of diminishing returns linked to depletion of the planet's life-sustaining resources overtaken our ability to stay in one's place and allow ourselves the idleness local knowledge demands? Similarly, Michael Davidson, in an essay about Ed Dorn and his relation to Olson, writes that, quote, place as a strictly geographical term no longer exists. It has been so totally mediated by entrepreneurial capital that one locale is the same as any other. So the ground might be here in Gloucester, but the only way we can make that ground an actual occasion, as Whitehead had it, or the whole of the condition of space, as Jeremy Prynne had it, is if this lecture becomes a circular curve, the condition of the cosmos, where the cosmos becomes myth. And that quote from Jeremy Prynne is from a letter that he sent to Ed Dorn that Ed read in the lecture that I played for you. So now I was really starting to get onto this lecture. Now I was really starting to figure out what finding one's place was all about. And so so tonight I will give you what's not on the flyer, which is a new subtitle, namely The Special View of History, Part 2. And that's because of what Olson wrote when he was preparing the materials for the first Special View of History. And this is what he wrote. A man's life is an act of giving form to the condition or state of reality at the exact moment of his birth. So therefore, error or truth in the execution of that imperative is the whole shot. As it happens, I was born on April 4th, 1953. Which turns out to be the exact day that Olson at Black Mountain receives in the mail Vincent Farini's magazine, Four Winds, which became the occasion for Maximus Letter 5. In fact, that week, in 1953, a run of Maximus poems were started, including Letter 6, from which the quotes on the flyer that Henry made for this talk were taken. So here's a more full context. And polis, fisherman, and poets, or in every human head I've known, is busy both the attention and the care. However much each of us chooses our own kin and concentration. And a few lines later, so few have the polis in their eye. So these are the poems that Olson was writing the week I was born, which is slightly mind-boggling, at least to me. But as for the actual content of Letter 5 of Maximus, which is about Henry's uncle, or to Henry's uncle, I have to go back to Amiel's book, A Little History, in which he makes clear that Olson depended on Vincent and his wife Mary as the one brother and sister that I have, and that the so-called slam against Farini and Four Winds, the magazine that he published, has been taken out of context. And this is what Amiel says about that. One of the things that Olson is trying to say here in Letter 5 is if you're going to have an independent society, which is this magazine, an independent community, then it has to be as good as any other endeavor. I think at some point he compares it to a fishing vessel where everybody on your crew would have to be tested. You wouldn't want to have somebody on that boat on your crew just because you heard they were good. That could be very dangerous. So Olson, in this poem, engages Vincent. And I will always be grateful that I was engaged in that way in my education. First by Norman O'Brown at UC Santa Cruz, and then at the University of Colorado when I met Ed in 1977. In very much the same form as Robert Duncan says when he talked about the force of Charles and his use of Black Mountain. He saw education as spiritual attack. On the first level, we can take it as to attack a subject. There also was a kind of spiritual attack, it seems to me, on students frequently. He wanted things to happen in them. I don't mean he wanted things to happen in his classes. He wanted things to happen in his students spiritually. Charles wanted to produce a new and redeemed man. This is actually Charles's alchemy. In a way, this lecture, Finding One's Place, started 3 weeks ago when I picked up a few books about Olson at the Encinitas Library. Encinitas is the town that I live in Southern California. It's my place, which I've written about in my book, Coastal Zone, which Henry talked about. But the lecture really starts earlier than that, at least as far back as 1963, when Robert Duncan also used the words of the blurb on the flyer. He said, someone here asked a question about care and attention, and we did get that the only place you have any care or attention is right where you are. Right where you are in the poem, or right where you are in the event. And that's when Olson read his poem, Place and Name. Here are a few lines from that poem. A place, as term in the order of creation, and thus useful as a function of that equation. Example, that the place where the horse sacrifices go of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is worth more than a metropolis, or for that matter, any moral concept, even a metaphysical one. Robert Creeley was quoted in the introduction to the Special View of History that Olson was trying to break the habit of history as some discrete ordering apart from what energies or active forces were the case, and that the only place the materials of history could obviously be was where you were, if they were to be there at all. So bearing in mind the gunslinger's caution that all is transhistorical, functions have no date, let me throw out a few other dates that make up this particular special view. I've already mentioned 1960 and when Ed Dorn's essay was published, and 1981 when he gave the memorial lecture to Olson, and 1953 when I was born. The other years I want to talk about tonight are 1390, 1742, 1847, and this week. And by the way, it's not a literary inheritance I'm tracing. It has more to do with orality and visuality than literacy. But I do want to bring in other writers who have inhabited this ground and talk about how they got there, most of them not usually mentioned in the same breath as Charles Olson. And I'm thinking of Geoffrey Chaucer and Henry Fielding. That's partly because I've been teaching a class in British literature over the last 4 months while I have been preparing and not preparing this lecture. And sometimes the two activities became confused. But the nature of that confusion is, for me, very much what Finding One's Place is all about. So I'm going to start with Chaucer. Garrett Lansing, who's here tonight, took us to see Jack Hammond's medieval castle yesterday, where he used to live. And one of the things I found out while teaching this British literature class is that I, too, have a special connection with Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. I told you that my birthday is on April 4th, which, it turns out, is when the Canterbury Tales begins. That is, here are some lines from the very beginning of the Canterbury Tales. And the youngest son hath in the ram his half a course a runna. That is, the poem starts when the sun is halfway through Aries. The astrological sign Aries, the ram, 15 degrees Aries, April 4th. And so I want to play you, just for the pleasure of the syllables, as Olson would say. Right, join Xfinity. I mean, I got it.
Let's see now who shall tell another tale, for truly the game is well begun. Now tell it ye, Sir Moke, that ye can, somewhat to quit with the knechter's tale. The miller, that for drunken was all pale, so that unnaith upon his horse he sat. He nulled a valen, neither hood ne hat, ne abade no man for his courtesy, but in Pilatus' voice he gan to cree and swore, be armous and be blood and bones, he can a nobler tale for the knowness, with which he will no quit the knechter's tale. Or roasted so that he was drunk of ale, and said, a bit, Robin, me laver brother, some better man shall tell us first another. A bit, and let us work and thriftily. Be God's soul, quod he, that will not he, for he will speak, or else go me way. Our host answered that, tell on a devil away, thou art a fool, the wit is overcome.
Did you understand that? That's English. It's Middle English. It's where English came from. I would not have understood that without a translation. But I will tell you that this is the beginning of the Miller's Tale in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And it's the second tale of the series of Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. The first tale of the Canterbury Tales is told by the knight, the noble knight, the chivalrous knight. And the host of the Canterbury Tales wants to follow the hierarchy of the social hierarchy of the Middle Ages at the time. And so he wants to have the next toll told by the monk, who is the next in order of the Middle Ages hierarchy. But then in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, the drunken miller interrupts and insists that he be the next one to tell his story. And that's what you just heard. The miller was drunken and so pale that he was almost falling off his horse. He didn't have his hood on. He didn't have his hat on. He didn't care about anybody's courtesy. But in Pontius Pilate's voice, he began to cry, I want to tell a noble tale for you all, which will I now will give a different version of the knight's tale. Our host saw that he was drunk and said, please, Robin, brother, some better man shall tell us first another. Come on, let us work thriftily. By God's soul, quoth the miller, I will speak, or else I will go my way. In other words, quote, There are no hierarchies, no infinite, no such many as mass. There are only eyes in all heads to be looked out of. So the miller, if you know the Canterbury Tales at all, then goes on and tells this tale, which is in a completely obscene parody of the Knight's Tale. And it's very funny. This is not the only time in the history of poetry when a large man under the influence of alcohol has assumed the stage and held forth to an audience, some of whom found his lecture unwelcome. I will play just a little bit more.
No, hearkeneth, quoth the miller, all and a sum. But first he mak approach the station, that he am drunk, he know it be my son. And therefore, if that he mispake or say, wheated the hour of Sotheric, you pray. But he will tell a legend and a leaf.
Now hear you, all and some, but first I make a protestation that I'm drunk. I know it by my sound. And therefore, if I misspeak or say, blame the ale of Southwark. But the point that I'm trying to make here, or one of the points, is this. When Chaucer is introducing the various characters in the prologue to the Canterbury Tales, the last group of pilgrims that he introduces are the so-called untrustworthy servants, including the miller, but also a sumner and a pardoner, also a monsipole, and myself. There were no more. In other words, Chaucer includes himself, the narrator of the poem, among the rogues, and by so doing, makes a pretty funny reference to the beginning of Dante's Divine Comedy, when Dante meets the famous poets of Limbo and includes himself among them. And Chaucer does this not because he's a thief or some kind of untrustworthy servant himself. Rather, by beginning the Canterbury Tales with the knight and miller, Chaucer makes a clear statement that he is writing no longer from within the world in which he had for all his life served. On the contrary, he is now standing outside that world as an independent and by no means uncritical observer. He is not an untrustworthy servant. His position is even more radical. He is a servant no more. As Charles Olson with the Democratic Party in 1945, so Geoffrey Chaucer with the court of Richard II in 1391. The radical act, the difference between this and other poetry has to be recognized. Finding one's place is to move from slavery to freedom. But there's more. Chaucer shows us a world in which our view of hierarchy depends on our own position in the world, not on an absolute standpoint. The pilgrims in Chaucer's tales are grouped on how they work and what they do, not on ideas of chivalry or any other ideal conception. Written in vernacular English, his is a purely comic and narrative art, a fierce respect for things as they are. A churl's tale in which harlotry is tolden. I have in my notes here to check Olson's The Escaped Cock and his correspondence with Francis Boldereff, but that story, as of today, is evolving, and so that will have to wait for another time. Anyway, The Miller's Tale finds the physical world enough. Its plenitude, its charm, its energy, its rules, an idea of order sufficient to man's needs, a world temporarily unshadowed by last things. Characters in such stories live for the most part as though no moral imperatives existed beyond those intrinsic to the moment. They inhabit a world of cause and effect, pragmatic error, pragmatic punishment that admits no goals beyond self-gratification, revenge, or social laughter. To be secular is to exist in a place where no moral qualifiers are allowed to exist, an animal world in which instinct takes the place that reason holds for man, a world in which instinct and necessity are one. The heart, by way of the breath, to the line, said Olson in Projective Verse. And later in an essay called Bill Snow, he wrote, "It's the secular I don't think is going to go out of our bones yet." And later in that essay, Olson has a rather startling prediction of our current war on terror. Check this out. Courage is suddenly a new word in the dictionary, that we are surrounded by enemies and must stay fit. It sounds like athleticism to me. And when all that is only demonstrated by self-consciousness of that it is, games are being played. I'd go straight from nature to the world. If form ever did lie in tales and on short stretches of distance between personally known towns, already the collector of port duties on wool in the city of London in 1390 had it. So there's one reference to Chaucer and Olson's collected work. Another time he refers to Chaucer is at the beginning of his piece called Proprioception. After Olson details the old psychology of feeling being linked to the heart, the liver, the bowels, and the kidneys, he says all of that is stasis, or as in Chaucer only, spoof. Today, movement at any cost. So let's move on to 1742, when another comic writer, Henry Fielding, is trying to make a case for his novel, Joseph Andrews, one of the first novels in English. And he's having a rough time trying to classify it. It may not be improper, he writes, to premise a few words concerning this kind of writing, which I do not remember to have seen hitherto attempted in our language. One of the great things about the 18th century novel in England was that people were just making it up as they went along, because there wasn't a tradition of fictional prose, and there were no conventions to follow. If you know it, think of Tristram Shandy a few years later, 1749. So what Henry Fielding finally settles on as a description of his novel that he's writing is this, a comic epic poem in prose. And this novel is very funny. I will read you a small sample in a little bit. But comedy, as we saw with Chaucer, also involves realism. And this is Fielding again in his preface. Perhaps there is one reason why a comic writer should of all others be the least excused for deviating from nature, since it may not be always so easy for a serious poet to meet with the great and the admirable. But life everywhere furnishes an accurate observer with the ridiculous. This was actually Fielding's second attempt. This novel, Joseph Andrews, was Fielding's second attempt to respond to the success of a rival, Samuel Richardson's Pamela, or Virtue Rewarded, a novel that was published 2 years before, 1740. Pamela is a novel of an innocent young girl who is rewarded for her chastity by a marriage proposal from the squire who had been trying to seduce her for the entire novel. And Fielding could not believe that such a novel had gotten popular. So he first tried to undermine its success with a novella called Shamala the next year, where Pamela is reimagined as a very different character, not young and innocent and virtuous, but duplicitous and very carnal. But then the next year decided to invent a male version of Richardson's character, a virtuous and innocent young boy. Besides putting other fictional characters in his story, he also puts in real people and places. This is from the novel. Quote, within 4 hours, he reached a famous house of hospitality well known to the Western traveler. It presents you a lion on the signpost, and the master, who was christened Timotheus, is commonly called Plain Tim. And this inn was an actual place outside London that Henry Fielding put in his fictional novel. And it was a place that everybody who had read this novel knew about. And so, in this novel, as Olson says in his special view of history, there was no separation between fact and fancy, the real and the imagined. So, there's humor in this novel, constant improvisations and spinnings and intrusions into his own novel. Fielding constantly interrupts the story that he's telling and gives little disquisitions about his feelings about life. But it's also a novel that charts a period before the stratification of social classes, when rich and poor mingle throughout in what today is hard to imagine and would be called revolutionary. Like Geoffrey Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales, Henry Fielding includes all of the characters of his society and has them clash verbally with each other. And making the decision to represent this revolutionary society, which is one of absolute equity, also necessitates revolutionary form. Here's a short excerpt from Joseph Andrews. Lady Booby resolved to preserve all the dignity of the women of fashion to her servant, and to indulge herself in her last view of Joseph, for that she was most certainly resolved it should be, at his own expense, by first insulting and then discarding him. And then Fielding interrupts this story. Oh, love, what monstrous tricks dost thou play with thy votaries of both sexes? How dost thou deceive them and make them deceive themselves? Their follies are thy delight. Their sighs make thee laugh, and their pangs are thy merriment. Thou puttest out our eyes, stoppest up our ears, and takest away the power of our nostrils, so that we can neither see the largest object, hear the loudest noise, nor smell the most poignant perfume. If there be anyone who doubts all this, let him read the next chapter. That's from the name of that chapter in Joseph Andrews was called Saying of Wise Men, a dialogue between the lady and her maid, and a panegyric, or rather satire, on the passion of love in the sublime style. And the next chapter after that is called In Which, After Some Very Fine Writing, the History Goes On. It's also relevant to say that this was a novel that was published in stages, in serials, so that the reading public had to wait a month or two before they got the next installment of the novel. And so there was always a sense of beginning in the chapters of this novel, as if for the first time. But I wanted to hammer home the idea that the comic writer is also the realist writer. And here I shift to a literary critic of the 18th century, a really bright a bright person. And this is what he says. Traditionally, there is a tendency to see literature and the other arts as having a tenuous connection to politics, at most. The aesthetic, the argument goes, is above the political. Meaning, not only better than, but beyond, and having little to do with the political. In this model, the critic tends to look at the organization and appeal of the formal attributes of the poem, often pointing to its representation of universal themes. I hope I don't have to point out the silliness of this argument to anyone here tonight, but I would point out that this is still very much the model in academia, where I make my living, despite our so-called liberation from the new critics. And the new critics, and most college and university literature programs. But the 18th century was also notable for something else. It wasn't just literature and politics that were melded together. It was all branches of knowledge. And here's that critic Lee Morrissey again, who says, "Today, literature has come to be associated generally with the literary or the aesthetic use of words, and it is often thought to be separate from many other fields. During the Restoration and the 18th century, however, literature was a very capacious field and could include drama, history, natural philosophy, which we would today call science, political philosophy, and poetry." That quote reminds me a lot of Olson's attempts to remake the curriculum at Black Mountain and in Jack Clark's Curriculum of the Soul. And while we can find this capaciousness in Dryden and Swift and Pope, and certainly in Milton, perhaps the most politically radical of all English poets, and whose most famous works were written in this time period, where we find it most is the 18th century novel. It's an international world that is cosmopolitan. Just as Chaucer traveled to France and Italy as a diplomat and absorbed the work of Dante and Boccaccio, the major 18th century novels are often engaged globally rather than domestically. The most famous 18th century novels are populated by world explorers, such as Robinson Crusoe and Lemuel Gulliver in Gulliver's Travels. The landscape of the Restoration and 18th century novel is the terra incognita of colonial locations, the new world that Britain was increasingly engaging. Of course, the new world that Britain was increasingly engaging also included us, the colonies, as the plaque at Stageport Park we saw yesterday testifies. Interestingly enough, it was Ed Dorn who got me interested again in the 18th century. When I was an undergraduate at UCLA, I had learned, naturally enough, to value the Romantics, and I thought that Pope and Dryden were a little too arch and contentious. And Ed, as he did every once in a while, told me I was full of it. They're us! One of his favorite books at the time was Samuel Johnson's The Life of Richard Savage. And I can tell you tonight that The Life of Richard Savage is an amazing piece of work and maybe should be your next trip to the library. Anyway, there's one more thing I want to say about Fielding before moving on. Because Fielding is constantly correcting himself and elaborating on previous points and interrupting what he had said just a few pages before. As in letter 15 of the Maximus poems, where Olson writes, it goes to show you, it was not the Epi Sawyer. And he also says, you go all around the subject. And I said, I didn't know it was a subject. Art is most itself, is true art when it makes itself not through the conventions of the universal, but as Theodore Adorno thought, by virtue of its own elaborations, through its own imminent process. Lawrence Stern understood this in Tristram Shandy as the only true law of the novel. The novel is the art of digression. This is why, ultimately, craft has little to do with whether or not a work is a successful piece of art. The most powerful and sinister gambit of what Adorno calls administered society is to promise the freedom of individuality while simultaneously prohibiting it. Art is a response to this repression. Unlike the graphic arts, drawing or photography, unlike tracings, the rhizome pertains to a map that must be produced, constructed, a map that is always detachable, connectable, reversible, modifiable, and has multiple entryways and exits and its own lines of flight. It is tracings that must be put on the map, not the opposite. Mapping the ground, we walk. On first looking through Juan de la Cosa's eyes. It's what the AWP, in its all-consuming ambition to institutionalize poetry, never does. And it's what comparison and classification don't do in their attempt to mute the active displays of knowledge, what's said and what's seen. So the last thing I want to mention tonight is the other word that follows from the polis, namely politics, not Donald Trump, whom I still believe will self-destruct imminently. But I'm talking about, again, Peter Anastas's Decline of Fishes, an example from here in Gloucester. And again, Amiel's book, A Little History, on which I've leaned heavily tonight. Amiel says, it's almost unimaginable, but extremely valuable for our understanding to understand what dissent can mean and what assertiveness can mean and how it can be tied, how political thought, action, and what placing the body literally in line can mean, and how that can be tied to the imagination, to the imaginative faculties, to the creative possibilities, and how constrained we are, how constrained things have become in so many ways. Amanda, what did you say was happening tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow morning there is a proclamation by the Mayor of Gloucester about National Gun Violence Awareness Day, which is tomorrow, June 2nd. The proclamation will be at 9:30 at City Hall. encourage everybody to wear orange, and then we'll have a candlelight vigil at 7:30 at the Universalist Unitarian Church.
Fabulous. Thank you. I told you that Garrett Lansing had given Sarah and I a tour of Gloucester yesterday. After we dropped him back at his place, Sarah and I followed a mail truck because we had to make sure to get our mail-in ballots posted on time for next week's California primary, because we believe that our two votes are going to put Bernie over the top. And I understand, and when I did that, when I gave our ballots to the very gracious postal driver, I remembered our book club in Bolinas, California, in the late 1980s. Sarah was in this book club. So was I. So was Bob Grenier. So was Shao John Thorpe. So was Joanne Kiger. There were a few others who dropped in every now and then. At one point, our book club was reading Maximus 3, the Maximus Poems, Volume 3. And I remember wondering whether Olson would note somehow in the poems Kennedy's assassination, since those poems were mostly arranged in chronological order around that time. At Vancouver that year, Olson said that we have to get back to the etymology of history and politics. Quote, otherwise, we're simply getting caught in the event, either of the society, which is one form of what's boringly called history, or the event of ourselves, which is also that damn boring thing called personal history. Last week, I saw an old letter from another Massachusetts poet. It started like this. Won't you please tell me, when you answer my letter, who the candidate for president is? This is the fall of 1847, when Emily Dickinson was 16 years old. I have been trying to find out ever since I came here and have not yet succeeded. Has the Mexican War terminated yet? And how? Are we beat? Do you know of any nation about to besiege South Hadley? If so, do inform me of it, for I would be glad of a chance to escape if we are to be stormed. I suppose Miss Lyon would furnish us all with daggers and order us to fight for our lives in case such perils should befall us. Olson was a bit more savvy than Emily Dickinson in terms of national politics, but there was a time when he gave it all up to find a more central place in which to construct a republic, in gloom or otherwise. A place as term in the order of creation, as he said in that poem, Place and Name, that I read earlier. So I think it's instructive to compare Charles Olson with possibly the most apolitical poet that we have in English. This is an article about Emily Dickinson that I just read last week. Scholars have combed her verse and prose for mention of the Civil War, which coincided with her greatest outpouring of verse. But her inspiration during those years seems to have been resistance to high rhetoric. Edmund Wilson may well be right in claiming that she never referred to the Civil War in her poetry. Her father's commitment to the Whig values of compromise, he had served a term in Congress and campaigned for Zachary Taylor and Henry Clay, may have tempered her response. While Julia Ward Howe was writing her saber-rattling battle hymn of the Republic, and Walt Whitman his drum taps, Emily Dickinson was quietly demolishing myths of heroic pomposity. here's a poem of Emily Dickinson's that I had never seen before last week. It's a short poem. Finding is the first act. The second, loss. Third, expedition for the golden fleece. Fourth, no discovery. Fifth, no crew. Finally, no golden fleece. Jason, Sham, two. That's an amazing poem. I'd never seen it before. The writer Peter Benfrey goes on to talk about Dickinson's language, oblique and sharply objective, which can be seen as one response to the degraded verbiage of the Civil War era and the Gilded Age pieties that followed. A voice raised against the pompous posturing of both sides. She once mentioned to Reverend Higginson her adamant resolution to never try to lift the words which I cannot hold. As with Charles Olson in Maximus 5, I am a ward and precinct man myself and hate universalization. Believe it only feeds into a class of deteriorated personal lives anyway, giving them what they can buy, a cheap belief. The corner magazine store, O'Connell's at Prospect in Washington, has more essential room in it than programs. 3 weeks ago, my wife Sarah, who's here in Gloucester this week with me, offered to read a draft of the lecture while I was writing it. And I said to her that it was still in a nascent state. We argued, as we do occasionally, about the pronunciation of that word, nascent or nascent. But the next day, I realized that this lecture had to end in a nascent state as well. That is, finding one's place is finding a place where one can move freely, can act without any restraints but those self-imposed, as limits are what any one of us are inside of. Every place, according to Olson, is an opening place and can serve as a gate inward that can be used to return outward after further growth. We don't exist until we act. It's the kinesis of the thing. No event is not penetrated in intersection or collision with an eternal event, says Olson in a later note on letter number 15. Or in other words, the local contains the eternal. Finding one's place is a constant action, a means of travel without necessarily going anywhere, because one's place is always being invented and might even be another's place as well, plus the space between. Just find a place to make your stand and take it easy. This is eternity. This now. The writing is nothing. The being in a position to write, that's where they get you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you. I didn't know really what to expect when Henry invited me. I didn't know whether I would be in a big auditorium with a PowerPoint presentation or just hanging out here in Vincent's home in the Gloucester's Writing Center. So in that spirit, I would encourage any of you to participate in this lecture. with questions or with readings of your own work or, you know, anything that you would like to talk about.
Struck by the quote from Emile's piece about the fishing vessel, about having a crew of tested fishermen, and it made me wonder, first, what does Emile know about fishing? But second, how do you construct a crew but for the testing? And it's in the process itself that the testing happens. And I know of no fishing crew constructed any other way. You don't have a test for what to do when a storm comes, but the storm. So I, although the point of that that quote I don't disagree with, I found that to be a faulty description of fishing or cruise or process even. And it just sort of struck me because I've been thinking about, you know, dealing with Olson myself and dealing with the assumptions about Gloucester and about the industry of Gloucester and the people of Gloucester and what Gloucester means, how taken out of the context of the place, a lot of these theories or ideas become in their own way a mythology without having the practical, without carrying over the truth of their origins.
Well, Emile, in that quote, was bending over backwards to try and paint Charles Olson's Maximus Letter 5 as something other than an attack on Vincent Farini, because that's what it's been taken as, really. You know, that's what it's, you know, Olson's great diatribe against his fellow Gloucester poet and dear friend. And, you know, if you know that poem at all, he's pretty rough, especially when at the end of the poem, as Vincent says in his autobiography, when Olson says, there's no place we can meet. There's no place you and I can meet. You're not anywhere. You're anywhere where the winds fly, you know? And so Vincent took it to heart, man. I mean, he was really bothered by that poem. And so
I was bothered by that poem too, but for different reasons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so
what reasons were you bothered by?
The assumption that Charles Olson should tell Gloucester what Gloucester needs in a poem was felt a little bit out of place also. I mean, there's a certain conversation that Olson has with Gloucester in the Maximus poems that I don't know was a true conversation. It might have been a monologue.
I couldn't possibly say. What do you think?
I thought it was, Olson doesn't talk that much there about Vincent in his work. There's probably about 3 or 4 poems. And I think there was a turf, you know, there was a turf battle there. And Olson was giving him both barrels. And I know Vincent was terribly hurt by the whole thing, but it didn't. They still continued to be great friends after the burn wore off.
Well, that's the larger point, that these were true comrades, you know, which is what I said that Olson said that Vincent and his wife were his true brother and sister. I don't know, Garrett. What did you think that this was a slam somehow against?
Well, I remember a time had Jack Hammonds at dinner. Both Charles and Vincent were there. And Harry Martin and me. Somebody else. Anyway, Vincent was, this was downstairs. The dinners were always in a little hexagonal room with individual tables. So everyone sat at his own table and helped himself from the central table, which had the food on it. In other words, you weren't helped by somebody else. You helped yourself from the central plate. This was Jack's idea. And Vincent said how disappointed he was by being rejected constantly. He'd send out poems and they'd come back. And he felt was rejected all the time. Charles very mildly said, don't worry about it. This happened to me all the time. Vincent, at that point, had regarded Charles as more successful. But what the idea of success was still hanging in the air at that point very much. This was about 1961 or 62. Vincent heard that because he had sort of thought that anything Olson said would be published or had written would be published. But Olson very gently said, that's not true. Don't worry about it. Be calm. Continue sending out your work. Don't worry about rejection. Everyone feels rejection.
Yeah, I mean, rejection goes back to...
I would like to thank the speaker for a very well-researched paper on Olson. As a newcomer to Gloucester in the last few years, and also a newcomer to the group that we're talking about, including Olson, I find that looking at Maximus, it's very intimidating. It's large, he has a lot to say, and I think you've given us a few more handholds on how to get into him, what sort of person he was. It may be that Farini is easier to catch on to than Olson, but you've given us a picture of someone who defies easy categorizations, and your comparisons, I think, raise good questions about who he was and who he might be to a new reader.
Thank you for that. I thank you for that. I should say that before the lecture started tonight, I was talking with
Elizabeth.
Sorry. And Elizabeth said, so you're the authority on Charles Olson? I said, I have no idea what he's talking about. So, I mean, but, you know, I am here to give you my incomprehension in the hopes that it can be as valuable as comprehension, really, because, you know, it's just us chickens, you know? So we're all here trying to make the best of things.
I think the only authority on Charles Olson was Charles Olson.
I mean, I enjoyed Fielding when I read Fielding, but I never thought that you could take Fielding and Olson and put them together if there was anything there, and you just showed something.
Yeah, somehow I saw it. I can't vouch for that authority of that connection. It has to do with improvisation, though. I mean, there's a famous line by Olson that says, who knows what a poem should be like until it's there? And that was really liberating for me, you know? I mean, I must tell you. And so Fielding, with his constant, you know, like, well, how'd you like that? You know, and his you know, endless digressions really did remind me of Olson's Maximus, you know, and his eagerness to correct the record, never to be satisfied with stasis. But, you know, you always had to be moving on. You always had to be, like, evaluating things under new circumstances. I mean, I really think, you know, I quoted in the lecture several times a line from Olson that said, "This is eternity, this now. Time to get on with it. Time to move," you know. That to me, that's the most important thing that I got from Charles Olson, which is, it's time to move on. It's time to get with it. It's time to use, you know, what you know as a person, to find out for yourself. I took that to heart.
On some levels, it's being alive.
Well, people die when they're 20. People die at all times.
No, yeah. But that condition of moving on.
Yeah.
Well, I could tell you a little story.
Great.
It ties together a couple of things that you mentioned tonight. I had a landscape company for a long time. And the most remarkable memory of that period was when I hired a young fisherman, or someone who was trying to leave fishing. He's trying to leave the family boat. And this is his first step on land. He was probably only 19 years old, but he'd already spent a number of years fishing. And one day, maybe within the first week of our acquaintance, I had to pick up a heavy log. There was nobody else around. And I got one end of it up on my shoulder, and nobody came except this fellow. He just showed up out of nowhere. Got the other end of it, and without any words, we took it over to where it needed to be, and that was that. And I thought, wow. I don't know if he certainly never worked in landscaping before, but he had an immediate sense of place. And so when you told Emil's story about testing, about not wanting to go out without someone who's never been tested, I don't read that necessarily as somebody who's an expert on fishing, but you could make an assessment of somebody to know whether he would fit as part of the team, somebody who's worth being with in that way. And that's what this fellow immediately evidenced, because he had that. Even though he had never been in my place before, he immediately made it his place like that. And he,
he was present.
Excuse me?
He was present.
Absolutely.
And that was your boat.
Well, somehow we got these.
But you can't be present all the time. I really think that that's important too, you know? I mean, there's a... You can't let it become a contest, you know, because most of the time we lose. One of the great things about sports that I always repeat is that in baseball, if you are successful 30% of the time, you're great. You are fabulous because you are hitting, you know, at a great, great percentage, you know. So finding one's place, sometimes it's luck, you know. Sometimes it's not a matter of rigorous training. It's not a matter of striving and straining to achieve the top of your profession, it's just being there. It's just being present. It's just a matter of luck. I don't know. I think that the people that I've studied with, that I've been fortunate enough to study with, they're mainly people. They're not. They didn't teach me anything. There's a great part of my teacher Ed Dorn's essay about Charles Olson's poem called "What I See in the Maximus Poems," and he said, "We can't take anything of use from Olson. We can't take anything of use from Olson because we can't separate out terms from the poem. The poem exists on its own. So the form of the poem is large. It's not anything that you can analyze and pick apart. You just have to see it and acknowledge it. We can't use it. We can't pick it apart. We have to just acknowledge it and understand that it's in our world."
I got a quote. I heard this. I think I heard it at the Crow's Nest. I wrote it down, and it's just one of those quotes that I liked. And it's, I think it has something to do with some of the stuff. And it was, "When the lights are out and the ship is going down, you better know where everything is." It's a fisherman.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Olson had a sense of that? He knew where the things were if he needed to when the lights were out.
Am I aware?
No, do you think Olson was aware?
Some really simple things. The only reason I kept reading Olson was because he was writing about Gloucester, and I missed Gloucester, and I wasn't in Gloucester. So I kept reading Olson. I mean, there's one line there in Maximus, I don't even know if it's his or if I've got it right. And it's the only one that what struck me emotionally in the whole book was, "God damn me, God damn my misunderstanding of you." And to me, that was a heavy line.
Exactly, yeah. No,
that's the only one that I could, it resonated with me. Besides, well, it resonates when he's talking about Lufkensteiner, because I walked by Lufkensteiner and I know where the Soviet Free Library is. But most of that stuff I had no idea about, these old Greeks, except for Peter Nastas. He calls himself an old Greek now. We're in the 70s, but.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just making this up as I go along. But I think an important word for Olson is provisional. You know, I mean, you find out for yourself. You do the research. You go to libraries. You read. You look around. You talk to people. You collect the things. You reach conclusions, but it could all be wrong. You know, you have to live with that uncertainty. I mean, that's. I didn't know Charles Olson. I never met him, but I know I could have hung out with him because, you know, that's the vibe that I get from his work. Is that, you know, it's not true that. One has to be learned and scholarly to pick up on all of the historical references of Olson's poetry. If you think that, you're not reading him correctly, because he's just, you know, assembling the results of his historical study. This is what he's found. These are the conclusions that he's made. You might make your own other conclusions, but that's That, I mean, there's a great improvisatory quality about Olsen that I picked up on early on. You know, then here we are. What are we going to do about it?
But he also connects with what came before. It, you know, he's in this moment, but he's in this moment as a repository of all the moments that came before.
Yeah, you read a lot.
Yeah, if anybody wants to, there's 3,800 books over there that he read. Make an appointment and check them out.
It's amazing. But you can't check them out.
No, you'll have to stay there the rest of your life.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
You can really take
them
off the scotch right now.
Joe, thank you.
Yeah, thank you
all for being here. There's probably more wine.
Yes. Great.